Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lisa Thompson, and I'm the program coordinator in the Center for Local Health. Welcome. I'd like to welcome each of you to the first in a series of the Local Health Department Leadership Lunch and Learn orientation webinars. And I want to let you know these webinars are part of a recently launched program called CHANGE, which is connecting health administrators, focusing on networking, governance, and education. This program was launched in May of 2015, and it's intended to orient and introduce local health department administrators to national and state partners and resources that support public health practice and service delivery. As part of this program, a delegation of new administrators and full-time health officers attended the National Association of County and City Health Officials Conference in July. During this conference, participants had an opportunity to attend sessions which provided them with access to public health leaders, innovative strategies, evidence-based practices, and peer networking. Among the sessions attended, Introduction to Management Essentials training provided health officials with the tools to strategize their organization's future, interpret and act on financial information, and to demonstrate leadership to engage stakeholders. This afternoon, we have over 50 registered and participating in today's webinar. Please be sure that your phone is on mute, and please do not place your phone on hold during the webinar to assure that all participants are able to hear the presentation. To be responsive and thorough in answering questions, we will have time at the conclusion of the presentation for questions. Those questions that are not able to be answered or that require input from other Bureau subject matter experts will be compiled and addressed in an FAQ to be released after the webinar and or incorporated into another Lunch and Learn webinar. If you have any questions during the presentation, please send those to the Center for Local Health email at dhhrdphclh@wv.gov. This is the beginning of what we hope to be an evolving and growing training program for local health department administrators. An evaluation will be sent at the conclusion of this webinar, and we will use your feedback to improve and develop additional training resources. At this time, I would like to introduce Amy Atkins, Director of Center for Local Health.
Lisa, good afternoon, everyone. So as Lisa mentioned, today's webinar is the first in a series of webinars, and they're intended to provide a high-level overview of the topics. So we recognize that in 1 hour, it may not be possible to address all questions, or there may be very detailed questions that would require us to explore and build out another webinar. But we hope that they will provide you with kind of a high-level overview, and then through that process, we can learn where there are additional training needs that we can address as a bureau. So we have two others in the works. In October, we'll focus on infectious disease epidemiology, and then in November, we'll focus on environmental health, and we'll continue to use your feedback to plan additional webinars past November. So clearly, the Center for Local Health has been focusing on workforce development in a number of ways, with the May Forum for Local Boards of Health, with this webinar series, and we have also supported a session at the Public Health Association, and we'll continue to do that as a priority to support the work that you do. I would like to let you know that we are working very closely and in partnership with the Office of Epidemiology and Prevention Services, Environmental Health Services, the Central Finance Unit, and other offices and centers that support local health departments, and we appreciate their time and effort in putting these together as well. So this is the beginning, it's a first step and a start, and we hope that you will provide us with your valuable input at the end of the session so that we can continue to build on these opportunities moving forward. So we thank you very much for your attendance today and look forward to your feedback and questions. Thanks, Lisa.
Yes. Also, I want to let you all know that joining us in the room today is Brad Cochran with the Office of Environmental Health Services, Amy Atkins, you've already heard from her, Linda Lipscomb with the Center for Local Health, Rebecca Schmidt, the Division of Threat Preparedness, and then also here today to present today's webinar on West Virginia Basic Public Health Performance Standards is Brian Skinner, General Counsel for the West Virginia Bureau for Public Health. Prior to joining the Bureau for Public Health, Brian served as chief counsel for the Committee on the Judiciary of the West Virginia House of Delegates. During his 11 years of service to the legislature, he also provided legal counsel to the Legislative Rulemaking Review Committee and the Commission on Interstate Corporation. Brian has also been employed as an assistant attorney general, an assistant prosecuting attorney, and he has represented low-income clients as a staff attorney with Mountain State Justice and Appalachian Research and Defense Fund, Inc. Brian has also operated his own private practice and was an adjunct professor with the clinical law program at the WB College of Law. And with that, Brian, I will turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you. So welcome, everyone, and good afternoon. This presentation is going to be much of an overview, and it's going to be focused on kind of the legal support for the system, the public health care system in West Virginia. So everything else that you're going to hear in the subsequent webinars is kind of based on what the legislature has set out as the public health care system in the state. So let's have at it. We'll just start with some of the basics. First thing I want, during the presentation, you're going to see citations to not really much U.S. code, United States code, which is federal statutes, but many references or citations to West Virginia code. And so I just wanted to show you what those look like first, so you'll know what those are when you see them, because I tried to cite back to the code or to rules whenever it was appropriate. So the first thing you'll see is when you see the WV code section, there's three numbers normally divided by dashes, and the first number is the chapter, the second is the article, and the third is the section. And so that's the way West Virginia code sections or citations are broke down. So normally it's section 1 of Article 2, Chapter 16. There's also going to be making references to Code of Federal Regulations, which are often referred to as the CFR. And again, normally the first two numbers are the title, and then there'll be sections after the designation for CFR, or Code of Federal Regulations. And we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about state rules. And we call our regulations, what the federal government calls regulations, we refer to those as rules in West Virginia, and mainly because the way we write our rules is a little different since they go through the legislature. In the federal government, those regulations are proposed by an agency, and Congress really doesn't have an opportunity to weigh in on them except by making statutory changes. That's different in West Virginia because all the agencies have to submit most of their rules to the legislature, and those are enacted as actual bills, and they have the same, they're considered having the same rule of law. So you'll see the citation looks similar to the statutory, except there's an R in there for the rules. And then we will be talking a little bit about state policy and procedures, not so much about local, but as you are aware, your county commissions and your boards can have their own procedures and policies. Those citations can all be very different, and so I don't have any examples of those. But those are basically the three sources of law we'll be talking about today. So I thought I'd first touch on what the West Virginia legislature has set out as West Virginia public policy. And that's important because everything flows from the statute. And so I think it's important to understand how the legislature has defined the public policy of the state with regard to public health. And you can see, and you can find that, and there's the citation to Chapter 16. Chapter 16 includes most of the law with regard to health, particularly with regard to public health. And you can see the legislature has expressed that our public policy is to promote the physical and mental health of all of its citizens and to prevent disease, injury, and disability whenever possible. The state also defines, the legislature defines the state's responsibility to assist in the provision of essential public health services, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means because the legislature has actually defined that phrase. So Chapter 16 establishes a state public health system to work in conjunction with local boards of health to provide basic public health services, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as well, that encourages healthy people and healthy communities. So those two phrases, essential public health services, are incredibly important when you're looking at what the public, defining the public health system in West Virginia, and particularly the relationship between the state public health system and the local boards in providing the basic public health services. So as I noted, this is kind of the basics, and so the public health, the essential public health services, as I said, are defined as core public health activities necessary to promote health and prevent disease, injury, disability. This information, this definition, comes from some national work that occurred several years ago in the 90s or the 80s and 90s that kind of defined what essential public health services are. And the West Virginia legislature adopted that in 2000 when they made significant changes to the code in Chapter 16. So you can see when you're looking at this, there are three basic components of essential public health services: assessment, policy development, and assurance. And over on the right-hand side, there is that circle, and you'll see on the outside the words assessment, policy development, and assurance. And so that signifies this is an interactive system. It's not a linear system. And so the governance, those things that are inside, the research, the system management, all those things within the circle are the governance, and that puts everything together into an entire system that's coherent and it functions. And so there's a central public health, or a central concern of the leadership of the public health system is the governance of public health that is, and it's a community responsibility. It means that the community needs to be empowered to become more involved in policy development. Because when you see those essential public health care services that are in there, you can see that those are very much the things that you find at a community level. So so around the outside, assessment is the need of the community, and that sort of starts the circle, because that's where you have to start with this system. And it allows the leaders of the public health system, whether local or at the state level, to think and act strategically as well as tactically, and decide what the best strategies for improving health and to engage in action planning. So the policy development plays a role throughout this. And so even though it's only part, it looks like it's part of that, you can see how it would be a major component of the entire process because it protects and improves the public health. It's the mission and vision, development of a form of a policy development that is important to not only after the assessment component, but to make sure the assurance or the manner in which these public health services are implemented or enforced in some cases. So, like I said, the components within SIDE, or the 10 organizational practices as they're often referred to, grew out of a lot of efforts made in the 80s and 90s, and then in 1989, the Public Health Practice Program Office of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention initiated this process to identify the core organizational practices. And as I noted, these 10 organizational practices can be seen as providing the operational definitions for the public health support function. The West Virginia legislature adopted all of this, and you can find this definition in Chapter 16, which basically sets out all of these things in terms of evaluation, monitoring, health, and diagnosing, and investigating, in terms of assessment, developing policies, and also enforcing laws. And so it's important to know that the legislature just didn't come up with this on its own. It comes from a long history of evaluating the public health system nationally. So that's what essential public health services are. Basic public health services, which are something that the local boards are most in tune with, are those. Again, this is from the West Virginia Code, and it defines it as those services that are necessary to protect the health of the public and which local boards must provide. So the local boards have to do this. This is a shall instead of a may. And there are three areas that the legislature has defined as basic public health services. And you can see those there, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with those. But in case you're not, you can kind of look at, this kind of sets out what each of those areas are. And so under community health promotion, there's the assessment and reporting, facilitating community partnerships and mobilization of the community. You can see in these a lot of those things you saw in that circle a couple of slides ago. These are all parts of essential public health services, but the legislature has decided what the core basic services should be, and this is what they've set out. Under environmental health protection, disaster preparedness, disease control and epidemiology, issuing permits and inspecting facilities, and investigating complaints. So you can see here a little bit more of the aspects that go to assurance and evaluation, not so much of the, well, I suppose there's some assessment there in disease control and epidemiology. And then communicable or reportable disease prevention. Again, we're looking at surveillance, prevention and control, treatment, in this area. So again, you can see this package. You can go find these things in that. Those essential public health services, they're there. So this slide is to sort of take a look at what the entire public health system looks like. And it is certainly a collective endeavor. You can see there in the middle, there's the health department, and I think that signifies both the local and state, but you can see all of the different components, the network of organizations all have to work together to make this system work. It's just not the local health departments or the state. And so that's with this attempt to show the linkages between not only government, but non-governmental entities. So I thought, again, in the basic portion of this, just to kind of take a real quick look at what the state public health care system, public health system looks like. And so, in 2000, there was a reorganization of the system, and the Bureau for Public Health was put under a super secretary, in a sense, for DHHR. And there are various bureaus, though, within the Department of Health and Human Resources, and public health is one of those. And so this sort of shows you the various bureaus that exist under or within the umbrella organization of DHHR. And this is focusing on the bureau. I'm sure you're probably familiar with the commissioner. This is share a little bit about what the vision and mission of the bureau is. And so then, certainly as part of the state public health system are the local boards, and we'll talk a little bit more about the relationship between the state and the local boards in a moment, but I think this might help to understand that we've got each county under law going back to the late 1800s was responsible for their own local community, and those were by county boards of health, in some cases municipalities, but at that time, in the late 1800s, they were each county as the a political organization of the state. How we divided the state up was responsible for public health within their community. The law provided later for collaboration and combinations of both municipals and counties themselves, and that's occurred. We have a couple combined counties, and then over on the right-hand side, some various municipal county combinations, consolidation. So just real briefly, this is kind of a nice way to visualize the public health care system in West Virginia, and it's all based on those public health care services down at the bottom. I already talked about the environmental, communicable, reportable disease, and community health promotion. They are really the foundation for this, and that's really a governmental focus. And so as you go up the pyramid, you're looking at those things. So as I noted, the basic public health service, that's a mandate that the local boards have. They also are, the legislature has given authority to local boards to engage in other types of public health care services, and in that case, enhanced is some things that local boards, if they feel like their community, if the community need, can move on to more enhanced public health care services and clinical services, but those things are not part of a mandate. And so that's why you see, and I suppose Amy explained to me, it's an interesting way to look at it, as you draw a box around that, those areas outside the triangle or the pyramid would be where non-governmental entities might pick up the slack in each of those areas as you move up the pyramid. So I think that's an interesting way to look at it as well. And so going back to that slide, it shows all the networking. The networking becomes more important as you move up the pyramid. So if that wasn't enough law for you, let's really get into it. So let's first talk about the powers and duties of the commissioner. And as you probably would have guessed, it's to enforce the public health laws of the state. And that's his primary responsibility, or hers, primary responsibility. But you can also see that it's the commissioner's duty to promote essential public health care or public health services to the citizens. And so that responsibility for that circle that I showed before is that of the commissioner. But the commissioner is also responsible or has a duty to monitor the administration, operation, and coordination of local boards of health for those basic public health services. So that is the film I can explain to one. So that's part of the commissioner's monitor the basic public health system.
If we could ask the folks to put their phones on mute, please, that would be very helpful. We can hear some background noise. Thank you so much.
All right. And so then another duty of the commissioner is to develop and maintain a state plan of operation, looking at the goals and objectives of the state's public health system, how to meet those needs, the methods for achieving the goals and objectives, what personnel, what money, and what additional authority may be necessary to achieve the goals. And in kind of as a catch-all, there are a few more. I've just pulled out some of the key duties and powers, but there's always the catch-all to exercise all other powers delegated to the commissioner by the secretary or by law to enforce the public health laws of the state. So from the commissioner's authority, I thought we'd spend a little bit of time talking about local public health. And so there is an entire article of Chapter 16 devoted to local public health. And what is in that article, there's several sections that set out how local boards of health are to be organized. And that's why you'll see that language, whatever organizational form is elected, because probably are aware you can have county boards of health, you can have municipal health, you can have combined county municipal, and you can have combined county. There is authority for all of those combinations in the law. And so what all of them have to do is ensure consistent performance of their duties, no matter what their organizational form, relating to basic public health care services and other services that they provide and the enforcement of the public health law. So that's the legislature's authority or mandate to local boards. One of the other things in terms of the relationship between the local boards and the state Bureau for Public Health, and I noted, I showed you before, the commissioner has a duty to monitor the performance and operation of local boards. And the legislature has provided a mechanism for doing that by requiring local boards to submit a general plan of operation or program plan to the commissioner for approval, but only if it receives any state or federal money. And I think that's important. If you look at the law and if you look at the history of local public health, it was really a local concern and was supposed to be locally financed. And that still exists in the law. And so if you, the statutes talk about it's the duty and responsibility of county commissions to support local boards of health. And they even have the authority to use liens or bonds and other sorts of, or levies, I'm sorry, not liens, but levies to provide the necessary funding. So if a local board of health didn't use any state or federal money, this particular provision would not be applicable. So this program plan must be submitted annually and comply with the provisions of the Local Board of Health Standards Administrative Rule. A little interesting side note is that this section of code actually came after that rule. You'll note, well, I'll show you later, that rule existed back as far as 1996, and this provision, I don't believe, was in place until 2000. So it's kind of interesting that it refers to a specific rule as opposed to just simply giving saying a rule. It talks about the Local Board of Health Standards Administrative Rule. So let's talk about that a little bit. There, I sort of talked about legislative rules and before, and what that means is that when an agency is authorized to promulgate, or actually we say propose, a legislative rule, they have to propose it to the legislature. They just can't go out and do it themselves by going through the comment period and other requirements that you would see at the federal level. So what they have to do is they have to go through all the public comment period and then file it with the legislature. There's a specific committee in the legislature, the Legislative Rulemaking Review Committee, which then looks at the rule to make sure it complies with the statute, that it doesn't exceed the statutory authority. And sometimes they go much further than that and actually get into the policy included in the rules. But those rules then go and are enacted during the legislative session. So each session, the legislature will evaluate and pass on legislative rules. And so that's what these are. And so there are two, and as I noted, the standards for local boards is very important because it's mentioned specifically in law. And that establishes the standards for operation, administration, fiscal reporting, quality assurance, and the types of programs that a local board must provide to the community. There's a second rule or regulation that is important to local boards, and that's the distribution of state funds. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But those are the two rules. Now, there are other rules, and Brad will talk to you about those, but those are rules that kind of flesh out the basic public health services in terms of what's required for inspections and disease reporting and those sorts of things. But those don't really go to the operation of the local boards themselves. So going back to this, there's a statutory requirement that the local boards provide basic public health care services in accordance with state public health performance-based standards. So that's important. So what are those standards? And we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But just as a preview of that, the law defines performance standards as objective standards such as rules or guidelines against which the local health department's level of performance can be measured. You can find that language there in the code. So it doesn't necessarily say who is to measure it, but I think when you look at I think it goes back to the commissioner's authority to monitor local boards of health operation. This is certainly authority by the commissioner to provide some standards to measure performance at the local level. And then there's federal regulation, and I'm sure most of you are aware of this. When there are federal grants, and when you receive federal grants, so you have to comply with federal regulations. And so this is a recent, it was a consolidation of some OMB circulars that existed going back several years. In the past couple of years, the federal government has tried to consolidate that and create a uniform administrative requirement, so putting them all in one place, as opposed to, I think there were at least three different OMB circulars that were applicable to federal grants. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. So let's go through some highlights of the legislative rules. So first of all, the Secretary of DHHR has the authority to propose rules, not promulgate, but propose, since the legislature really is the entity that promulgates them ultimately. So just going back to this 1996 rule for standards. So let's talk about what those standards are. So the rule provides direction in all of these things, all these categories, organization, program requirements, administration, financial management, facilities, reporting, and what happens if a local board is non-compliant. So I just kind of flesh out some of these things. Under organization, they must be organized under the requirements of Chapter 16, Article 2. And the rule in itself prescribes the number of meetings. A local board held in a county that has a population greater than 30,000 must meet no less than 6 times a year. And if the local board of health is in a county with less than 30,000, it need only meet 4 times a year. All the boards must comply with the Open Governmental Proceedings Act. And they must have bylaws, and the rule provides minimum requirements for those bylaws. It includes attendance requirements for board members, the number, duties, tenure, and qualification of members, a description of the process for filling vacancies on the board, requirement for written minutes and records of the board's actions, a description of the duties, an election process for officers. A quorum of the board for transacting business is a simple majority of the constituent membership of the board. All of that is specifically set out in that standards rule. The rule also provides that local boards must provide public health services and programs. And it specifically requires an evaluation of the health needs of the community it serves using generally accepted professional health needs assessment techniques. It requires efforts to prevent and control epidemics and investigation and containment of diseases and injuries through compliance with the requirements of 64 CSR 7, often referred to as the reportable diseases rule, regarding disease surveillance and epidemiological reporting. It requires promotion of a safe and healthy environment and maintenance of clean and safe air, water, food facilities, excuse me, through a program of routine public health environmental education and control. For promotion of healthy lifestyles, including provision of health education to individuals and communities, targeted outreach and the formation of partnerships and other community organizations, and the initiation and participation in mobilization of community for actions to improve health. Sorry. So the board must also administer public health sanitation rules as specified by the commissioner. Actually, the rule says director. And as I noted, that rule exists the reorganization, and prior to 2000, the commissioner was actually called the director. And so that language still exists in the rule, since the rule hasn't been modified since 1996. You also note in this list there's this is not strictly adhered to at this point. And Brad talked more about that in an upcoming webinar. But you know, the folk, you could see milk sanitation there and housing institutional sanitation. Some of those areas are broad, and so certainly there's a lesser focus on some of these than others. But you'll note that the rule provides that the board, local boards, to administer these as specified by the director, so or by the commissioner. So the commissioner may, in the future, want to highlight some of these issues, or in specific instances, find it necessary to focus on one area that may not be sort of a routine focus now. In terms of health services and programs, the Board of Health must, shall, implement a program of immunizations according to standards of pediatric immunization practices as published by the CDC. The board must conduct preventive health programs designed to promote healthy behaviors. It may provide individual health care systems, but services, I'm sorry, but not, it's not required. And that's because that, again, falls outside of those basic public health care, public health services. The board must maintain and conform its written policies and procedures governing patient or client referral, release of information, confidentiality, and the consent for staff to provide services to patients or clients, which must be consistent with federal, state law, rules, and regulations. The patient or client care protocols, including standing orders and medical directors, must be approved annually by the local health officer. And the board is authorized to charge fees for permits and services as those are authorized by the commissioner, by state law and rules. Most of you are aware there is a fee for permit rule, which fees for permit at a local level must adhere to. So with regard to the rule, also provides that the board must in a timely manner submit reports and records in compliance with any state law, federal rules, departmental policies. So that's a mandate that comes from the rule. So the rule also talks about general administration, including staffing issues. And this is, a lot of this reflects within the law, the code, but this rule also provides that the local boards may employ, don't have to, but may employ or contract for staff to carry out the duties and responsibilities within funding available. So it's important to note that the rule specifically says that the local boards need to be cognizant of their funding abilities when looking to employ or contract for staff. The rule also requires boards to have a written organizational chart, which indicates lines of authority and responsibility, and not only that, but must annually review it, that chart, and document within the minutes of an official board meeting that they've actually reviewed the organizational chart, including the lines of authority and responsibility. The rule requires that the local boards employ an administrator, or if not employ an administrator, at least designate a staff member or contract for an administrator to manage day-to-day operations. And if you look at the statute itself, it says the local health officer really has that mandate. This rule provides that especially in those situations where you don't have a full-time local health officer, I think this is what this is intended to deal with, if you have someone on the ground in the office on a day-to-day basis dealing with the operations where you don't have a full-time health officer. The rule provides that staff and consultants of the board or contractors or anyone providing services must, if they're required to have a license, they must be in compliance with licensure requirements. So if someone is working in a position that requires a license, then they should have the license, a valid license, and be completely in compliance with West Virginia law as it applies to licensure requirements. And then, and also that the boards must have liability insurance that is at least equivalent to that available to local boards through BRIM, which includes all staff, board members, and contracted services. So the general administration of the provisions in the rule that apply to general administration also go to policies and procedures, and it requires all administrative policies, procedures, rules, instructions, specifying operations and activities of the staff, including those that are patient and client related, to be written and readily available for the staff. So any procedures that deal with the activities and operations should be in writing. In terms of personnel management, the board must keep confidential personnel records for each staff member, and the board must review and reapprove or revise functional job descriptions, including those performed through a contract, every 2 years, at least every 2 years. And in terms of staff development, the board must provide an orientation program for all new staff, which should include or must include, at a minimum, introduction and discussion of all policies relating to the job, behavior expected, patient confidentiality, and an individualized on-the-job training to specific functions. The board must also provide training for staff who assume new functions or increase their responsibilities, or if they change their job responsibilities. And the board must also provide in-service and continuing education and related to current responsibilities for staff on an ongoing basis. So the rule also provides broad provisions, these are pretty detailed in many cases in terms of financial management. The board must participate in audits and be in compliance with the procedures of the state tax commissioner. The board must also include their most recent audit report when they submit their program plan. The board must also identify in writing the staff or contract staff who have the authority to handle cash, sign checks, or approve or disapprove expenditures. The board should maintain a cash reserve equal to at least the past 3 months operating expenditures of the local health department. And the board must establish a written schedule and procedures for reimbursement of employee travel and other expenditures. All contracts or memorandums, agreements, anything that binds or purports to bind the local board to any other parties must be in writing, no oral contract. The board has to and has a mandate to establish a procedure to monitor program costs, revenues, and expenditures. And no later than 30 days before the first day of July, the board has a duty to develop a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. And that budget has to identify and provide details of the operating expenses needed for each individual program and their activities. The rule also provides some requirements for the physical facilities themselves. So that they must provide facilities for the local health department. So a local board has to provide some place for the local health department to operate. It's their duty in this case. The board should be able to provide evidence that the buildings and grounds of the local health department are in compliance with all federal, state law, and regulations, so ADA. Any of those types of federal requirements or state requirements the board needs to be able to show evidence that they're in compliance. This is kind of an interesting provision of the rule, I think, that it also provides that the buildings and grounds must have at least one or more outdoor signs, which clearly identify the department. That's a requirement in the rule that there be at least one sign that clearly identifies the department's location. The board must promote protection of patient and client privacy, and there's certainly other federal law, state law that require that as well, but this rule also makes that a mandate of the boards. And the board must establish a policy prohibiting smoking or the use of smokeless tobacco in local health departments. The rule also has a section devoted to the program plan itself. And you can see here it sets out what's in the program plan. And these plans are to be submitted on forms, supplied, or at least approved by the commissioner. And you can see those are the components of a program plan as set out in the rule. So those program plans must be submitted annually to the commissioner or the Bureau no later than 30 days prior to the first day of July. And the board is required to conduct an ongoing planning process around those that commission. And it should also provide opportunities for, and it must document, have records of community and citizen participation in the planning, development, and implementing those programs. So there should be, to use the phrase, paper trail with regard to how the program plan is ultimately drafted, and showing that there was at least an opportunity for the citizens of the community to have some say in what the program plan should include. And then the commissioner must approve or disapprove the board's program plan based on its compliance with all of the things I've just talked about with regard to that of the contents of this particular rule. And then if the local board doesn't, the commissioner determines that the local board is not in compliance with the rule, the commissioner has the authority to withhold state aid funds until the board submits an acceptable plan to correct the deficiency. And that language is not, that authority for that language comes from the law itself, the statute. And so the rule actually is, for the most part, quoting the language that the authority of the legislature has given the commissioner in this instance. So then the next important rule is the one that deals with the distribution of state funds. And that rule, the authority for that rule and the contents of that rule come right from West Virginia Code. And the secretary is required, Secretary DHHR, remember, the secretary has the authority to propose rules, not the commissioner, is required to propose a rule for legislative approval for the distribution of state aid to local health departments. And you can see the legislature has set out what should be in the rule itself, a base allocation, an emergency fund, a calculation of funds for state support, and the distribution of remaining funds sort of based there, and then a distribution remaining on a per capita weighted population approach. There's also a provision in law that deals with a hold harmless provision that provides that local boards receive no less than state support that they received in 2009 for the next 4 years. That provision is no longer applicable. This statute was enacted in 2010, and the requirement for this formula was put in place in 2010. So the legislature wanted just to make sure that whatever a county received in under the formula wouldn't be less than what they got, at least for the next 4 years, what they received in 2009. But as we're in 2015, that's no longer out. So the rule, 64-67, is the rule for distribution. And this is the rule that the Bureau must follow in terms of calculating the distribution of state. It should be funds, not FUDs. Sorry about that. For local boards of health. And this was based on recommendations for the Center of Business and Economic Research funding study, which occurred I think in 2009 at Marshall University. So the whole regime, the mechanism here was based on a study by a third party to provide a formula that was hopefully fair to all the counties. So that's kind of hard, maybe hard to see. But anyway, so the West Virginia legislature appropriates funds to DHHR in the state budget, and then that amount is then distributed based on the formula. And so the formula is basically has an eight-step process. That first step is to look at poverty, a need factor, and that's the percentage of individuals in a county living below the level of income established by the federal government as being in poverty. Well, actually, I'll move on to that because I think, yeah. So you can see this is how the formula breaks down for an example. And so that is weighted at 40%. And that's the number over on the right-hand side. I think these are 2013 numbers. So the next step is to look at health status, and that's another need factor, and it's the years of potential life lost in a county, and that's given a 20% weight. Population density is the number, the density of individuals living in a county less than the state average at a 15%. Interventions, it's the number of interventions per 1,000 population above the state average in the county total. And so that more intervention gets weighted at 10%. There's a consolidation provision, which was intended to encourage consolidation of counties, counties to merge and work together providing local public health care services. And that indicator is the number of counties served by the local board, and consolidation assigned a weight of 15%. And then there's a weighted population calculation, then the base amount, and then the per capita distribution of the funds. So the commissioner has to complete these calculations as soon as possible, but not more than 2 weeks after the budget is passed at the legislature, which normally occurs in March in most years. And so we're looking at sometime in March, early April. After the completion of the calculations, the local boards are to be informed of their allocation as soon as possible, but in no case less than more than 4 weeks after the legislature has passed an approved budget and instructions in the budget. Then the commissioner is to distribute to the eligible local boards according to the procedures beginning the first day of July of the fiscal year for which the funds have been appropriated, or as soon as possible. I mean, there have been times in our history where the legislature hasn't been able to agree to a budget until the next fall, actually. So that hasn't happened recently, but that provides that it has to happen just as soon as possible. So this is just sort of how the quarterly payments are set out. Most of you are probably familiar. As I noted, there's a provision in law that provides for emergency funds, and those funds are to be used by the commissioner at his or her discretion to assist local boards of health to meet unanticipated financial emergencies. And the commissioner is given the authority to develop an application for local boards to apply. But if there aren't any funds obligated for emergency use by the 15th of May, those would be then distributed based on the provisions of the calculation that we just talked about. And so those monies are then dispersed throughout to all the local boards, just as all the other appropriations are. So I mentioned before, there are performance standards for basic public health services. And these performance standards were adopted about the same time, if not exactly the same time, as the effective date of those provisions that dealt with the reorganization of local woods health and the state, the Bureau for Public Health under DHHR. So these performance standards, some of you may be aware of, are, you can break them down into these following areas. And I've set out the number of standards that are in each of these areas. However, that's kind of a misnomer in that in many of these cases there are substandards within the standard. And so while it might say 9 financial standards, there are, it breaks them down in some cases into some substandards. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through this part of it, but one of the things when you look at the standards, there actually are many standards, but they have, some of those are considered class 1 or class A standards. And those are standards that were designed to be implemented immediately. And so you'll see in this instance that many of these are things that you might be familiar with in terms of communicable reportable diseases. When we go to the next slide, you'll see standards with regard to SID. There's another category of standards referred to as other in the standards that you have it before you that were intended to be implemented in the future but haven't been at this point since 2000. They haven't been implemented as yet, but you can see there are data collection for SID, survivor support, and those sorts of things, which are not standards that are currently applicable. So under community health promotion standards, you'll see community health assessment, community health planning, and implementation of those plans. And so there are specific standards with regard to each of these categories. Under environmental health protection, standards for training, disaster inspection surveillance, tattoos, body piercings, food establishments, child care centers, and manufactured home communities. Also, standards with regard to all of these categories. And some of these milk samples, again, Brad will go through a lot of these because, again, these standards were developed pre-2000. They were made effective in 2000, and there has certainly been a focus on some of these issues and not others. And as I noted, some were Class A and some were intended to be implemented later. So as we talked about with regard to the rule in terms of governance of the local boards and local health departments, there are standards here as well. And so these standards really, I think, are reflective of what we've already talked about. I don't believe they are inconsistent in any way with either what's in the rule or what's in the statute. You'll see membership requirements, organizational setting goals, compliance with federal law, all those things we talked about that were contained in the standards rule, requirements for bylaws, training and orientation. You'll see there's a requirement for the appointment of a health officer and ensure a merit system. There was no discussion in the rule about a merit system. That comes from the statute itself, which provides that the Division of Personnel at the state level is required to provide personnel services. However, there's certainly a county could opt out of that and have their own, but they would need to have some sort of merit system if they didn't use the state. And then standards with regard to hours of operation, services, marketing, those sorts of things. I think that these standards you didn't see anything specific with regard to marketing or hours of operations in the rule, but I don't think any of these things are inconsistent with that. I think under marketing you might say that signage requirement is the extent of marketing. But anyway, there are certain standards, and I think, again, these standards go back to what is legally required by the rule and the statute. These standards also contain personnel, budgeting, financial accounting, audit, and purchasing requirements. So, of course, where federal money is received, you must comply with federal requirements. And I mentioned this earlier. In 2013, late 2013, the OMB published the final guidance on the Uniform Administrative Requirements, cost principles, and audit requirements for federal awards. And this superseded and combined the requirements of actually 8 circulars, more than I mentioned earlier. So there were 8 different circulars that might, one or more of them might have been applicable to any types of funding received from the federal government. And so the federal government decided to streamline this federal grant-making process and monitoring of those grants to certainly it would ease the administration burden on the applicants and recipients in putting everything in one document as opposed to 8. So these were effective December 26, 2014. And except for the audit requirements, those apply to audit the fiscal year's beginning on that date, one or after. So these reforms, basically 3 main categories, administrative requirements. You can see what those circulars that it combined, cost principles in subpart E, and auditing requirements. And I'm not going to go through their changes from what were in the OMB circulars, but you don't really need to get into all those things now. And maybe that's the subject of a future webinar. So the guidance is divided into these various subparts. And so you can see there's definitions and general provisions and pre-award requirements and post-award requirements. So that's all I'm going to talk about with that. That's a whole hour and a half or more topic in itself, and so and probably I'm not the person really qualified to discuss it. So that's pretty much it. And so kind of to summarize, everything that we do, not only at the Bureau and at the local level, comes from Chapter 16. With regard to local public health, Article 2, that sets out not only the organizational structure, but the powers, the duties, the requirements, and also the permissive, the things that local boards can do. It is all set out in Article 2. That article's been around since the early or the late 1800s, and it's been modified over that period of time. In fact, if you go back to the early days, the local board of health consisted of the prosecutor, a county commissioner, and a local health officer. And then in the 50s, there was another revolution, and that's where you got the local boards of health as they look today, more like they look today. And so that all comes out of Article 2. So that's where your authority is really resides. And then the state, in terms of its ability to monitor the performance and operation of local boards, has 2 rules that it's promulgated. And that's the standards rule, which I'll be the first to say needs to be updated since it hasn't been so since 1996, but for the most part, it does a fair, it fairly reflects the statutory requirements that the legislature has established. I also think that when the legislature specifically refers to it, and as they did, they certainly believed when they were enacting the 2000 reforms that was the standard that they intended to be put in place. And then, of course, how the money that comes down that the legislature appropriates to the Bureau for distribution to the local boards, the formula for that is set out in a rule. And then, as I noted, these performance standards are mandated by the legislature. Now, it doesn't mandate what they are. It defines that they should be objective measurements. It doesn't specifically say what they are. But certainly the legislature intended that the local boards, that their work, how they operate both administratively and in terms of the program meet certain performance standards, and that's what those are intended to include. And then finally, whenever the federal government is giving money, they want to make sure it's used appropriately, and so local boards must also be cognizant of those requirements whenever they receive those awards. So, I don't know if anyone emailed any questions. Maybe we have some, and I'll try to take some questions. But if you do have questions, you can email them, and then we'll read them, and I'll answer them.
Okay. Okay. Again, like Brian mentioned, Brian, thank you very much for that presentation. If you do have any questions, you can email those to the Center for Local Health email. And again, that's dhhrbphclh@wv.gov. And we do have a few questions here. The first question that we received was, what other trainings are available for new health officers?
I'm going to let Amy take that one because that's out of my...
So I will let folks know that we're working with the Office of Epidemiology and Prevention Services to incorporate training for local health officers into the upcoming 2015 West Virginia Public Health Symposium, and we should get information out very, very soon regarding that. The dates for that are November the 19th and November the 20th, and it is held in Charleston at the Charleston Marriott Town Center, so that's something that's upcoming.
Okay, and the next question we have, and I can answer this. Will this webinar be available online? And yes, we are working to record the webinar and make that available online on our website. So as soon as we are able to do that, we'll let everyone know when it's available. Okay. The next question is, why isn't the funding distributed in equal payments?
So the funding comes out quarterly. The payments, the percentages increase throughout the quarter, and it's distributed in accordance with the way the state receives it. So instead of 25% per quarter, we receive it in those quarterly allotment percentages and disperse it in that manner as well.
Okay. And the last question that I've received is, where can I find the performance-based standards?
So Brian talked about Class A standards and then a broader set of standards. The Class A standards are the standards that are associated with the annual program plan, and they are accessible on the Center for Local Health website, and it's the website address is www.dhhr.wv.gov/localhealth/administration. If you go to the administration tab, there are several of the code and rule links that Brian referenced, as well as a copy of those Class A standards, and they are in a format that you could use to do a self-assessment and to better understand your agency's ability to meet those standards.
Okay, well, that's the questions we've received thus far. If we do receive more in our email, we will compile those and address them in an FAQ and release them out to everyone. So thank you all for joining us, and have a good day.